All right, so let's dive into this Supreme Court case. It's a real eye-opener, I think, for anyone who's ever had to deal with or even just heard stories about, you know, all those legal tactics that just seem designed to kind of drag things out and stall, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
We're talking about Chambers v. Nasco.
Okay.
And this one, you'll want to pay close attention because it really sets the standard for how far courts can go to punish, you know, bad faith behavior in lawsuits.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This case is a landmark decision that really clarified the whole concept of inherent power that federal courts have when it comes to issuing sanctions. Mm-hmm. And it's a, you know, a crucial lesson for lawyers, especially when we're thinking about those ethical lines, you know, the ones you just can't cross in legal proceedings.
Yeah, for sure. So what exactly happened in this case? I mean, it all started with just a pretty basic contract dispute, right?
Yeah, at its core, it was a contract case. We had G. Russell Chambers. He had agreed to sell a TV station to Nasco.
Okay.
But then, for reasons, you know, we'll get into a little bit later, he backed out of the deal.
I'm guessing that's when things started to get a little messy.
You could definitely say that. What makes this case so interesting, so unique, is that even before Nasco actually officially filed their lawsuit, Chambers had already started moving the TV station's assets around.
Oh, wow.
It seemed like he was trying to, you know, shield those assets, prevent them from becoming part of the legal battle that, you know, he must have known was coming.
So he was already, like, playing hardball before the game even officially began.
Yeah, pretty much.
And then what happened once the lawsuit was actually filed? Did he, like, tone it down at all?
Not really. In fact, Chambers and his lawyers, they kind of doubled down on the aggressive tactics. Throughout the whole lawsuit, they just bombarded the court with all these motions. And a lot of people considered them to be, you know, frivolous, pointless.
Mm-hmm.
They were also disregarding court orders and even trying to manipulate the court's jurisdiction, you know, to try and get an advantage.
So they were really pulling out all the stops, huh? Trying to throw Nasco off track. But I'm guessing the court wasn't having any of it.
You got it. The district court saw right through it and ultimately ruled in favor of Nasco.
Okay.
But here's where things get really interesting. The court decided to go beyond just a simple ruling, and they hit Chambers where it really hurt his wallet. They imposed a huge, almost $1 million penalty on him.
Wow.
Using, you know, their inherent power to punish what they saw as just blatant bad faith litigation.
Wow, that's a serious chunk of change. It sounds like the court was sending a very clear message that this kind of behavior just wouldn't fly.
Oh, absolutely. They were drawing a line in the sand. But hold on, because the story doesn't end there. The case, believe it or not, went all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Of course it did.
And they had to wrestle with a pretty big question.
All right, well, lay it on me. What was the huge question that the Supreme Court had to answer?
Well, the core issue was whether these lower courts, you know, could they use this inherent power to sanction misconduct, even in situations where specific rules didn't, you know, directly cover those actions?
Mm-hmm.
Think of it this way. You've got your rule book, right? But then sometimes, you know, you run into a situation that isn't really addressed in those rules.
Right, right.
So the question is, does the court still have the power to act even then?
So it's kind of like having a toolkit with all your standard tools, but sometimes you need, I don't know, a special wrench that's not in the set. Did the Supreme Court say the courts had that extra wrench?
They did. The Supreme Court ultimately upheld the sanctions, and in doing so, they really affirmed this inherent power of federal courts to step in and punish actions that are intentionally trying to, you know, undermine the judicial process.
Okay.
But this is a critical but. They also made it clear that these sanctions, you know, they have to be very carefully targeted, and they really should only be used as a last resort.
That makes sense. They're not just giving courts free rein to punish anyone they disagree with.
Right.
Right.
It has to be a clear case of someone deliberately trying to, you know, abuse the system. But that brings up another interesting point, I think. You know, we talked about how Chambers started hiding assets even before the lawsuit was even filed.
Right.
How does that square with the whole idea that, you know, each side in a lawsuit typically pays their own legal fees, what's often called the American rule?
You've hit on a point that definitely sparked some debate, and it's actually one of the reasons why this case is so important. It really forces us to grapple with some complex questions about the limits of judicial power. The Supreme Court, though, they address this head on, and we're going to dig into their reasoning in just a bit.
Okay, so how did the Supreme Court justify, you know, sanctioning Chambers for these actions that he took before the lawsuit even began, especially with that American rule thing where, like, Each side usually pays their own legal costs. I mean, how does that all fit together?
That's really where this whole concept of inherent power comes into play. The Supreme Court basically said, look, courts have to have a way to protect themselves. They need to be able to, you know, stop people from manipulating them. They said inherent powers are essential. Courts simply can't function effectively without them. It's not about like getting rid of the rule book or anything.
Hmm.
It's about having the authority to act when, you know, it's clear that someone's trying to go around the rules, trying to avoid the spirit of the law, even if what they're doing isn't like specifically spelled out as being against the rule.
Right, right. So it's kind of like having a safeguard.
Right.
Yeah. To make sure things stay fair and to keep people from taking advantage of the system.
Yeah.
But I bet some folks were a little worried about this whole inherent power idea. I mean, it does sound like it could be a slippery slope, right? What's to stop a court from just using it to, you know, punish anyone they don't like?
Oh, for sure. That's a totally valid concern. And it's something that the dissenting justices in this case, they were really worried about it. Justices Scalia and Kennedy, they agreed that courts need some inherent power, yeah, but they really questioned how far it should go.
What were some of the specific things they were worried about? What did they say?
Well, Justice Scalia, for example, he was super concerned about the scope of these inherent powers. Like, how far do they really reach? He thought courts definitely need a way to keep things, you know, orderly, to make sure people are behaving themselves in the courtroom, you know?
Right.
But he was really adamant that these powers shouldn't apply to things that happen outside of the courtroom itself. He felt like by sanctioning Chambers for things he did before the lawsuit, the court was kind of, you know, crossing a line.
So he was drawing a line between stuff that happens in the courtroom, where the court, you know, obviously has authority, and actions that happened beforehand, which he thought were outside the court's reach.
Exactly. And his argument was that if we start letting courts reach back in time like that, you know, punishing people for stuff they did before a lawsuit, it could really discourage people from, you know, doing things that are perfectly legal.
Mm-hmm.
They might hesitate to take any action at all, even if it's totally within their rights, because, you know, they'd be afraid that it could be used against them later on in court.
Yeah, I can see how that could be a problem. I mean, it's a tough balance, isn't it? Trying to prevent people from doing bad things, but also making sure that they're not afraid to do things that are totally okay. What about Justice Kennedy? What were his main issues with the ruling?
Justice Kennedy, he had a slightly different focus. He was mainly concerned about what this would mean for the American rule. You know, the idea that each party in a lawsuit usually takes care of their own legal fees.
Right, right.
His argument was, if we start letting courts punish people for things they did before a lawsuit was even filed, basically punishing them for breaking a contract, it would create this weird exception to the American rule. It would be like, you know, unfair.
So he saw it as a potential slippery slope, right? Where the line between a regular contract dispute, which is usually handled by state law, and a federal court sanction gets all blurry and confusing.
Exactly. He worried that this could give federal courts too much power over contracts, like they'd be stepping on the toes of state law, you know? And he also thought it could make the legal system, you know, less predictable, less fair.
Those are some pretty serious concerns. It sounds like there's this real tension, you know, between giving courts the power to protect themselves and the possibility of that power being misused or overreaching into areas where it doesn't belong. So how did the majority opinion address these dissenting opinions? Did they just, like, ignore them?
Oh, no, not at all. They definitely acknowledge that, yeah, there's a chance of things going too far. They emphasize that inherent powers, they got to be used sparingly, you know, with a lot of caution. They said the sanctions in this particular case, they weren't just about punishing Chambers for breaking the contract. It was more about the fact that he had intentionally repeatedly abused the legal system, you know, to try to get out of facing the consequences of breaking that contract.
So it wasn't just that he broke the contract. It was the way he went about trying to avoid responsibility for it.
Exactly. The Supreme Court, they were really careful to point out that Chambers had this pattern of bad faith. It wasn't just a one-time mistake, you know.
Yeah.
It was a whole series of actions, from hiding those assets before the lawsuit to filing those pointless motions to violating court orders. It was a whole pattern of behavior that showed he just didn't respect the legal process.
So the court was basically saying, we see what you're doing, and we're not going to stand for it. We're not going to tolerate anyone intentionally trying to manipulate the system. And we've got the power to step in and make you pay the price.
That's it. That's the message. And they also made it clear that they were drawing a distinction between, you know, punishing someone for just breaking a contract, which is usually a state law issue, and punishing them for intentionally abusing the court system, which is a federal issue.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. They were trying to strike a balance, right? Protect the courts, but also respect the line between state and federal law. So the big takeaway here seems to be that the Supreme Court is giving courts a pretty powerful tool, but it's one that has to be used carefully and responsibly. They have to think about the potential consequences. But what does this all mean for lawyers, you know, practically speaking? How has this case changed the way they approach litigation?
Chambers v. NASCO has really shaken things up in the legal world. It's like this big warning sign, you know. It's telling everyone that judges are really cracking down on people who try to game the system. It's not just about winning anymore. It's about playing fair and making sure the system stays, you know, credible and respected. We're going to get into the nitty-gritty of what this means for legal strategy in the next part of our deep dive.
Okay, so we've talked about how Chambers v. NASCO really sent a strong message about, you know, the consequences of using bad faith tactics in litigation. Mm. But how has this case actually changed things for lawyers out in the real world? Like, what are some of the practical things they have to keep in mind now because of this case?
Well, I think it's been a real wake-up call for the legal profession, you know? Chambers v. NASCO basically put everyone on notice. It said, hey, judges are taking this stuff seriously, and they're not going to tolerate anyone trying to abuse the legal system. It's not just about winning anymore. It's about doing it the right way, ethically, you know, upholding the integrity of the whole system.
So it's not just about knowing the rules, but also knowing the ethics behind them.
Right? Yeah.
And being responsible when you're representing your clients.
Exactly. This case has really highlighted the fact that lawyers, you know, they have a duty to their clients. Yeah, but they also have a duty to the court. Yeah. They have to be strong advocates for their clients, of course, but they also have to be ethical, and they got to advise their clients against doing anything that crosses the line, you know, anything that could be seen as bad faith.
It sounds like a tough balancing act, you know. On the one hand, you've got to fight for your client, but you also don't want to get in trouble with the court by pushing too hard.
Absolutely. And I think Chambers v. NASCO has made a lot of lawyers think twice before, you know, using certain strategies. They're just more aware now of what could happen if they file a bunch of motions that don't have any merit, or if they try to delay things on purpose, or if they do anything else that looks like they're trying to manipulate the system.
So it's kind of like a preemptive strike against bad faith litigation.
Mm-hmm.
Lawyers know that if they try to pull any shenanigans, they could face serious consequences. So they're less likely to even consider those kinds of tactics.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, it's a big risk now. Lawyers have to really think about the pros and cons. I mean, sure, maybe a certain tactic could help their client, but they also have to consider the very real possibility that they could get hit with sanctions. And those sanctions, well, they can be pretty serious. I mean, they could have to pay money, or their case could get thrown out, or they could even face disciplinary action from the bar.
So it's not just about the client anymore. The lawyer has to think about their own reputation, too, their own career. That's a big change.
Yeah, it is. This case has really shown everyone just how connected everything is in the legal system. It's not just about individual cases or individual people. It's about having a system that everyone sees as fair and trustworthy, you know.
So Chambers v. NASCO has had a ripple effect. Everyone's more accountable for their actions now, and everyone's been reminded that the legal system isn't just a game to win. It's a way to resolve disputes fairly.
Yeah, exactly. It's about remembering that justice is about more than just the outcome of a particular case. It's about how we get there. The process matters, and we have to protect that process from people who are just trying to use it for their own benefit.
Well, I think this deep dive has really given us a lot to think about. Chambers v. NASCO, it's definitely a landmark case, and it's still having an impact on the legal world today. It's a reminder that courts have a lot of power to make sure people behave ethically and to protect the system as a whole.
It's a case that everyone involved in the law should know about. Lawyers, judges, even people who are just going through a lawsuit, they should all understand what this case means. It really highlights how important it is to not just know the rules, but also to understand the ideas behind those rules, the fairness and justice that the whole system is built on.
And I think the biggest takeaway, the most important thing to remember, is that getting justice doesn't just mean using legal tricks. It means acting ethically. It means respecting the system. And it means knowing that winning at all costs can sometimes end up hurting everyone, even the winner. It can damage the whole foundation of the law.